about how one needs to understand the ontology of the quantum state if one's a realist about it. Okay. Now, given some of the flavour of the talks we've been having this morning, and in particular, given David Merman's masterly presentation this morning, I think I probably should say a little bit about why on earth one would think in these thingy terms of the wave function. And the thought is not, as one might have concluded from listening to this morning's talks, that these characters are falling prey to a kind of simple-minded literalism about the quantum formalism and just harebrainedly reading off as real structures things which are there in the theory. You know, crazy guys, why do they do that? No, what's going on is that they think that there are certain explanations that quantum mechanics gives us, and these explanations only function if the quantum state is recognized to be a real thing, or at least, perhaps more weakly, that it's possible to read off realistic descriptions of the way the world is in virtue of statements about the quantum states of the various things in it. Those two needn't be quite the same thing. So that's the character of the claim. It's that we have these explanations. These explanations only work if you're a realist about the quantum state, and that's why it's ineliminable. You've got to believe in it. And my co-author on this paper, David Wallace, if he were giving you this talk today, he would give you the following example, so I'll give it to you in his stead. Now, here's an analogy. So why do we believe in the existence of dinosaurs? Well, it's in virtue of the fossil record, and we have our paleontological theories saying, well, you see the footprint there because there really was a big thing with a great big ugly foot that trod there some time ago. Now, that explanation of the fossil record only works if dinosaurs existed. Right, we have a theory accounting for the evidence which postulates some stuff in the world, dinosaur stuff, dinosaurs, and those explanations only work if we admit their existence. If we said that the dinosaurs were just a convenient fiction for predicting the existence of the fossil record, we'd be laughed out of town. The claim is that quantum mechanical explanations are of the same character. Of course, one might quibble about the details of that, and that would be an interesting thing to do. But by and large, it's a dangerous thing to go instrumentalist in quantum mechanics, to go anti-realist, because you may find that some of your most cherished claims, your most cherished explanatory claims that you'll teach your students about the nature of the physical world will go out the window. So just a word of warning. Okay, here's the plan for the talk then. I'm going to begin by presenting that flavor of conceiving of this thing which is to be represented by the wave function that goes by the name of wave function realism, explaining the kind of view that Albert and Bell had. It's going to turn out important there to draw a distinction between configuration spaces and physical spaces if we're to make sense and get rid of certain understandable but I think ultimately misguided objections to this kind of view. So I'll be talking about that under the challenges to wave function realism section. So this is people like Brad Monton, Peter Lewis, and Tim Maudlin have made a certain class of objections to thinking of wave function realist terms. But I think there are actually, so I don't think those kinds of arguments work, but there are good reasons not to be a wave function realist. And it's actually going to look like a pretty unnatural physical picture. And that motivates what David and I call the space-time state realism, where we take, ultimately, the picture we're going to have is that that thing represented by the quantum state lives not in a high-dimensional space, 3n dimensions for n-dimensional non-relativistic quantum theory. Rather, it lives just in ordinary space-time, but it's a certain rather kind of special thing living in ordinary space-time. It's going to be a non-separable field of a certain kind. And that will give us an ontologically continuous picture as we go from a non-relativistic quantum mechanics with fixed particles to variable particle numbers all the way up to quantum field theory. So we don't have to worry about having to have a radical shift in our quantum ontology if we're realists and we want to actually have a physically realistic picture of the world which ultimately is going to be made out in terms of quantum field theory. So that's the plan. Okay. So to wave function realism then. So first of all, I think it's useful to notice a subdivision in the realist, generic realist pictures about quantum mechanics that I think Albert and Bell to some extent, Albert certainly, Bell to some extent, are glossing over. So one thing one can do is just say, and this is our main topic of interest, well, the quantum state represents a thing. That's one way you could go. It's the fundamental item represented in the theory, and it's the fundamental representation of the stuff in the world. On the other hand, you might have an alternative view which says, I'm not actually going to think of the quantum state as itself a thing, as a kind of a field like Bell and Albert suggested. Rather, I'm going to say that the quantum state, the statements about the states, quantum states of systems, can be translated into statements about what definite realistic properties things actually have. And the traditional way that that's gone is via the eigenstate-eigenvalue link. So you say that, I needn't take the state of this system I've got here to be a field-like entity in the world. I should take that piece of mathematical stuff, a vector in the Hilbert space, mathematical stuff, to represent a certain class of properties that this thing has. For example, it might have spin up in some direction. So those are two distinct kinds of views one might have. Ultimately, it's plausible that if you take that kind of picture where you use an interpretive rule to go from the mathematics of the quantum state to realistically construed properties in the world, it's plausible that you're ultimately going to be pushed towards hidden variables if you go that way. If you try and do that in a Everettish kind of picture, it sort of forces you towards taking the preferred basis problem seriously. What was the other one? Oh, yes, and of course it gives rise to the problem of tails in dynamical collapse theories. So one might have a good reason to avoid that second class of realist accounts. For Bell, I think the main reason he was saying in quantum mechanics for cosmologists that one needed to think of the field as being a real physical thing was because he was thinking of it as a causal agent which pushed particles around, right? That's one way of thinking about the Bohmian picture. And if a natural way then of thinking of that which is doing the pushing is as a field analogous to the electromagnetic field, which is a paradigmatic pusher. Okay. Now, we're taking the first class of accounts to consider. And now we need to say, well, what kind of thing is this thing if the quantum state represents a thing? In answering that question, it's maybe useful to begin with some general thoughts about what it is to specify an ontology. And there may be lots of different ways you could go about thinking about this, but one really seems to me straightforward way, may not be the only way, is to start off by identifying what are the objects in the theory you're going to ascribe properties to are, identify the property bearers, and then say something about the character of those properties which you're going to ascribe to these items. Now, when we're doing fundamental physics, the extent to which we can get an intuitive grip on the properties postulated by the theory is typically going to be limited for the good reason that fundamental physics is going well beyond the level of the everyday claims where our normal concepts get a good grip. We're not going to be able to ostensibly define the kinds of properties that appear in fundamental physical theories. We can't point, we can teach colors by just pointing to stuff. For a large class of everyday properties, that's the manner in which we get a grip on them, just by looking out in the world and learning to carve things up and recognizing some things as falling into that category and some things into the other. We can't do that in the case of fundamental theories. What we do in fundamental theories is we hypothesize some theory about how the world is. And our grip on the things we're saying in the theory typically has to be mediated by the role that the properties play in the theory that we're citing. Ultimately, of course, we're going to have some link up to the everyday world of our own experience. But now that we're no longer prey to the semantic doctrines of the logical empiricists, there's no call that the way of connecting theoretical properties up to experience need be by direct reduction. The dream of thinking that we could reduce claims at the theoretical level purely to statements about sense data, or even to statements about the directly observable, so not necessarily sense data terminology, that turns out to be a hopeless dream, and moreover, it was always fundamentally misguided in the first place. So we don't need to have a direct reductive account of the meaning of our theoretical terms. It'll be good enough if we can have some kind of story about how the stuff we postulate at the fundamental level is going to give rise to, perhaps some long way down the line, to that which we can recognize as the everyday world of our own experiences. Okay, and so to give an example of not trying to push too hard to get an understanding of fundamental physical properties, how do we understand the electromagnetic field? Now, I take it that the electromagnetic field is not itself something which you find irredeemably obscure. We don't find ourselves really pulling our hair out, I don't think, and saying, I simply can't understand what this Maxwell's theory is saying there is in the world. Yet, we don't, of course, have a direct grip on electromagnetic properties. We get our grip on, our empirical grip on talk of the electromagnetic field by thinking in terms of the motion of test charges and this kind of thing. But the field itself isn't reducible to the motion of test charges, even the motion of possible test charges. We understand the field by saying, what is it to assign a field? Well, it's saying that each point in space-time has some certain property attributed to it, which has a certain structure as defined within the theory, and here's the dynamics which tells you how that's going to evolve. Oh, and by the way, Lorentz force law, that's going to tell us how this is going to move charges around, and ultimately we're going to have a connection there up to experience. We also get the idea that the electromagnetic field is a causal agent that pushes things around. Now, the claim that David and I want to make is that we're coming to understand the quantum state as a thing isn't fundamentally different from that kind of process. We're postulating something in the fundamental theory. It's not something which we get a direct experiential grip on. We can't come to understand it that way. All one can do, all one can ever plausibly do in coming to understand the postulates of that which is postulated by fundamental physical theories is looking at the theory and seeing what it tells you. So we have to look internally to theory to get the meaning of the terms. Okay. Now, useful to make a couple of distinctions. Relating a little bit to the issue of rarefication from earlier this morning, but slightly different. So one important distinction, sometimes seems trivially obvious to say this, but it's surprising how often one can get tripped up, the distinction between the representation and the represented. So the distinction between the map and that which it's a map of. Now, typically what we're doing in physics is producing some mathematical objects, so these are abstract items, which we take to represent things in the physical world. And then there may well be a debate about exactly which bit of that mathematical stuff you've written down does indeed correspond to stuff in the physical world. And one can get that wrong, and one can get it right, and one can argue about how to do it. But there's a distinction between the mathematical representation and the physical stuff thus represented. Now, for our characters, those who want to be wave function realists, we have on the mathematical side a familiar wave function. That's a mathematical function, it's a mathematical object, which is going to associate complex numbers, or perhaps a little vector of complex numbers, to each point in a certain high-dimensional space. We'll call it delta. And here we're starting off with the non-relativistic quantum theory with fixed particle number, because that's where Albert and Bell were starting. Now that stuff, the mathematical side, then represents physical stuff. And the claim is that what it represents is a particular kind of field. Let's call it the psi field, which lives in a particular high-dimensional physical space. Okay, straightforward enough. Now let's also distinguish between configuration space, gamma, and delta, that space on which we said that the wave function we're interested in being realist about is to be defined. And it's here that I think Albert slipped up just a little bit. Okay. So what do we mean by a configuration space? I can't draw that many dimensions. So think of this as being a genuine configuration space, gamma. How do we understand this is a mathematical object. How are we to understand that? Well, what, of course, simple enough, each point in the configuration space represents a particular configuration of particles, or at least locatables, in a real physical space, okay, in a 3D physical space. Okay, so that's what a configuration space is. Now, our wave function realist doesn't really want to be a realist about configuration space gamma. They don't want to say this, that it's the wave function defined on gamma that we want to be a realist about. Because if one wants to be a realist in that kind of way, that means that there must be three-dimensional configurations one takes to exist. Right? So a configuration space is a representation of three-dimensional configurations. But that's not the ontological picture that the wave function realist has. What they have is this doesn't feature in the fundamental level of ontology. There is no three-dimensional space at the fundamental level. Okay. So what we have instead is the space delta on which the thing which we're going to be a realist about is defined. And this then represents a high-dimensional physical space. That might seem a kind of a footling distinction, but it's actually quite a significant one. It's the difference of whether three-dimensional spaces exist in the fundamental, a single unique three-dimensional space exists in the fundamental ontology, versus the question of whether the fundamental ontology really has the high-dimensional space of three n dimensions instead. And that's a difference that makes a difference. So for the wave function realist, we have the pair, the function and the space, which represents a particular distribution of properties, that is to say, a field in a high-dimensional physical space. And there's no three-dimensional space at the level of the fundamental ontology. An important point here. This is supposed to be a realistic theory. That is to say, the properties that are assignments of complex numbers to points in delta represent, what those assignments say is not anything about what the probability of finding particular particles at certain locations is. That's not the interpretation that we're giving of psi. Rather, psi is just supposed to be, these complex numbers just are supposed to represent a new class of intrinsic properties which are primitive. They're not to be explained in terms of anything else. You're going to get the story about where probabilities come in a long way down the line once you've given a dynamical analysis of the measurement procedure. Okay. Is that all right so far? Do we have any questions on that? Yeah. No. There are two kinds of, it might come out in, so I don't know quite what the character of your question is. I might be able to, that's a better answer, but not here. Two immediate kind of problems one might have with this theory. They're both along the lines of, look, I still don't understand what this is saying. It's all very well saying the wave function on this high-dimensional mathematical space delta represents some kind of field on some kind of high-dimensional physical space, but I still don't understand what that is. I don't have enough grip on that to count that as being a genuine candidate for a description of the way the world is fundamentally. The second flavor of objection is that, look, it's just not going to be possible to recover the world of experience from this kind of picture. If this is all that there is and there's some kind of field on here, it's a physical field on the real physical space, if that's all there is in the world, then it's not going to be possible to recover definite goings-on in the lab and definite observations of us as observing entities. And problems one and two here go together, actually, because it's typically because people say that I can't understand how that level of appearances would emerge, that I can't understand what these properties being postulated to points in the high-dimensional physical space are supposed to be. And so it's Bradley Montan, Peter Lewis, and Tim Maudlin who are particularly exercised by this kind of concern. Now, on the question of the possibility of recovering three-dimensional goings-on, I think it's particularly here that it's useful to distinguish between the configuration space, gamma, and this mathematical space here, delta. And the challenge that particularly Montan presents is that, well, precisely because we don't have any physical three-dimensional space here within which things could be configured, that means, and he's right in saying that, the objects over here, this delta, that's not a configuration space. In that he's right, but my response is that doesn't matter. His kind of worry is that if this isn't a genuine configuration space, if it doesn't have the structure of a configuration space, then there's going to be no unique way of, as it were, bundling up the different dimensions of this space into groupings of three, which is going to give us the properties for locatable three-dimensional objects. But there are two components of responding to that. And one is that, well, it may be true that delta isn't gamma. Delta is not a space of configurations. But that doesn't mean that it's as structureless as just R3n would be. In particular, it's going to have, if so long as the dynamics governing the wave function have the symmetries of three-dimensional spaces as they would in a normal non-relativistic quantum mechanical setting, then it's going to turn out that this space delta will indeed have that same kind of three-dimensional symmetries in it. That goes via, and there's a standard link between the symmetries of the dynamics and the symmetries of the space which you take the dynamics to play out on. So we need the space to have at least as much structure as is required to formulate the dynamics, but we don't want to give it excess structure which doesn't key into the dynamics. So what Newton was doing when he was saying that there's a preferred absolute frame is precisely introducing excess structure which the dynamics treats as symmetric. And so the dynamics doesn't distinguish between different solutions which are differently located with respect to the supposed absolute frame. So there's a sense in which that stuff which is postulated for the space doesn't actually have any grip on goings-on in the space, so it doesn't count as spatiotemporal structure. So it's a standard move, either as a matter of good conceptual housekeeping, to give the space on which one's specifying the dynamics the same symmetries as the dynamics does, or a stronger thesis, which Harvey Brown defends in his 2005 book, is that there's an analytic link between the symmetries of the dynamics and the symmetries of the space time. That is, it's going to turn out to be a necessary proposition, true in virtue of the meaning of symmetry, dynamics, space time, that the space time has to share the symmetries of the dynamics. Anyway, so that means that delta isn't totally featureless. It's going to have three-dimensional symmetries on it. And the other point is that in Monton's argument, his kind of permutation argument, which is going to say there's no unique way of picking out three-dimensional arrangements, he's paying too much attention to the synchronic structure of the space alone. But if we're going to be looking for the emergence of three-dimensional goings-on from the fundamental ontology, you're going to be using all of the fundamental ontology. The space, the high-dimensional space, is only a bit of it. The other thing you've got, of course, is the field, you know, the stuff that fills the space. And it's by the particular manner in which the field is arranged that we, if they can be, that we'd expect to recover three-dimensional goings-on. And then it seems highly plausible that, in fact, you're going to find those three-dimensional structures emerging. And this is the normal story that one appeals to, for example, in the modern Everettian take on the role of decoherence in picking up an approximately defined preferred basis in the and giving you a rough identification of enduring quasi-classical worlds. So there are two components going on here. That if we have a Hamiltonian, which is going to be a typical Hamiltonian, which is going to be such as to give us decoherence, and is also such that it has three-dimensional symmetries, then we're going to get emerging in the in this field here, autonomously evolving parts of the field, which obey approximately classical laws with three-dimensional symmetries in. And that's going to be enough that if we're actually composed of little bits of this field, just as a wave of the sea is composed of the motions of the particles in the sea, if we're made up in that way out of the field, we're literally made of this stuff, then we're going to see an emergent three-dimensional world around us. So I think that kind of worry that we can't recover the world of experience doesn't go through. What does that leave us to say about the starting worry about not being able to understand what the character of these properties is, these assignments of complex numbers to points in this space representing these field properties over here? Again, at this point, we just need to advert back to the electromagnetism case and say the situation is in principle no worse than the situation we faced there. This is what the fundamental theory postulates. If you're still puzzled about what these properties are, then just look closely at the goings-on in the theory, and you'll come to understand what's being postulated. Okay, so I think wave function realism is a tenable kind of position. Nonetheless, I don't think we should believe it. Basically, for reasons that it looks very unnatural physically, to my eyes at least. So one thing that, of course, that we're doing, I mean, the starting point in specifying the ontology was we're saying we need property bearers and we need properties. The property bearers are going to be the points in the physical space. The properties are those which are given by the assignment of these complex numbers to each of those points. But doing things that way is, of course, making a particular... it's adopting a particular way of writing down the wave function. Of course, this is we're taking the position representation as being preferred here. And it seems that we... we tend to believe that actually all of the different representations of the quantum state should be on a par. There's no fundamental difference if you would choose to represent things differently. But it would make a big difference to this kind of ontological picture, because it wouldn't go through at all, say, if we went and represented this in a position basis. Then we wouldn't have the same kind of ontological picture coming out at all. So to get this picture in which you do have clear bearers of properties, and then we have the particular manner of specifying the properties, we had to prefer position, and one might think that's unnatural. We've also preferred the Schrodinger form of the dynamics as against the Heisenberg or interaction picture, and again, you might think, look, these really aren't differences that make a difference, and the fundamental metaphysics, the ontology of the world, shouldn't depend on the precise manner in which I've chosen to express the fundamental mathematical object representing what's really there. Now, you can probably get around that with ordinary non-relativistic fixed particle number quantum mechanics, because when working in that framework, we do actually always typically use the position basis, and you might argue that perhaps it does look natural enough. But as soon as one moves to a varying particle number situation, things get hairy. So then we wouldn't have just a single space here. We'd have to have a whole bunch of them of increasingly varying dimensions as n increased. And while one might not be necessarily metaphysically opposed to that, this is getting pretty ugly now. And then things get really serious when you move to quantum field theory, where we don't have particles, properly speaking, defined at all, at their positions defined at all. They don't seem to be fundamental components of the mathematical formulation of the theory. There, of course, we have variable particle number. So we're just not going to be able to play this game where we say, you know, the fundamental space is this high-dimensional object here at all. One might take the view that really what one needs to be realist about in the QFT setting is a particular choice of the field configuration variables. So probably a number of people in this room have actually developed theories of this kind. But again, David and I would suggest there's a certain unnaturalness here. If one just looks at the mathematical formulation of quantum field theory, it seems much more natural to say, no, what we fundamentally have is a space-time, a normal physical space-time, on which we're defining field quantities. So those are the reasons we don't think one ought fundamentally to take this kind of line to the quantum ontology. It's just going to be physically unnatural when we go to a detailed description of the realistic physical situations. Okay. So let's try another option. This is what we call space-time state realism. So start with the idea that we want to keep that democracy about the representation. We don't think the particular choice of observable quantity should play a role in the metaphysical ontology that comes out. And one can keep that if instead of characterizing the state in a particular way, using a particular representation, you just say, well, you know, think of it just as the linear function of the dynamical variables. And in many situations, that's going to mean that we're just talking about a density operator now. The density operators are going to be the analogs of the complex numbers associated to particular points here. And one might have a worry that, well, if I found it difficult to understand what property was being assigned to a space-time point to a high-dimensional physical space point by the assignment of a complex number or an n-tuple of complex numbers, I'm really going to struggle if the intrinsic properties are being represented by this even more complex mathematical object, namely a particular kind of linear function. So that's one kind of worry one might have. The other component we need to have to specify the ontology is to identify what the property bearers are supposed to be. Okay, grant that the properties themselves are going to be represented by density operators, rho, what are the property bearers going to be? You could just say, well, it's the universe as a whole in these kinds of theories, but that's not going to be a particularly useful way of doing things, because then it's going to be very hard to see what structure is being attributed to the world. And so it's better if we start off with just looking at subsystems of the world. So suppose the world has a natural decomposition into subsystems. And we're going to assign a density operator to each of those subsystems. And, of course, an important point is that if we have subsystems A and B of the universe, then A union B is going to be a subsystem too. So as well as assigning a density operator to A and one to B, I'm going to have to assign one to A union B. And of course, we know that in quantum mechanics, this typically won't be a product of those. So we're going to have non-separability being worked in at the fundamental level in this theory. That represents an interesting contrast with the wave function realist picture. Because what they did by having this high-dimensional space here, the state of the whole could be specified by adding up the states of each individual bit. So fundamentally, the wave function realist picture is a separable picture. And the non-separability that we see demonstrated in Bell experiments and so on is going to be a result of the attempts to represent what's fundamentally a 3N-dimensional reality in terms of a 3-dimensional one. On the view we prefer, space-time state realism, separability enters at the fundamental level. You have the space-time, take all the different patches of the space-time, and assign density operators to each one. Now, again, these operators aren't supposed to be understood instrumentally, operationally, in terms of probabilities for measurement outcomes. That wouldn't be a realist position. I want you to take seriously the analogy with electromagnetism, where we're saying, here's some mathematical item. So in electromagnetism, it's going to be a field tensor, a Maxwell field tensor. In our theory, we have another mathematical item. It's a density operator. In electromagnetism, you have the field tensor. That represents the properties at a point in space and time. Similarly, the density operator represents the properties of space and time. And don't look for some other explanation of what these properties are supposed to be. That's just a fundamental posit in the theory. We have to become familiar with them by operating within the theory. Their meaning is given by their role within the theory. The other point is that a natural reaction is, now surely we can't understand such a complicated object as a linear functional to represent in just the basic primitive intrinsic properties of a point. But the response to that is, well, why not? Who says? Our familiarity with mathematical objects is just given by the way that we learn them at school. And it doesn't seem to me that there's any particular reason why the universe should obey some principle of mathematical segregation, whereby it's only the stuff that you get introduced to right at a young age is capable of representing the properties that there are fundamentally in the world. If we think that, you've got all kinds of families of crazy mathematical objects you can define, some of these may be useful in formulating physical theories, some may not. There's nothing to stop us just saying, this mathematical object will function in this kind of way, in this kind of theory, that's what the world's like. I said we were looking at subsystems and unions of subsystems. These ought to be natural. Well, the most natural way of doing this is just to look at regions of space-time. You could have a toy theory, a world of qubits or something like this, and then it'd be individual qubits and groupings of qubits that you'd assign density operators to. But the natural way to do it, particularly with the QFT context in mind, is by assigning states to regions of space-time. The advantage of this is that we can have a uniform ontological picture going from non-relativistic quantum mechanics to full quantum field theory. That might not be totally obvious in the non-relativistic quantum mechanics case, because there we do always tend to think in these kinds of terms or in these kinds of terms with a configuration space. But it's possible to reformulate non-relativistic quantum mechanics for either fixed or variable particle number in Fock space terms, where you build up the Fock space out of single particle states located in particular subregions of space-time. That's essentially rewriting non-relativistic quantum mechanics in QFT terms. So then the fundamental ontological picture here is that we have the arena of goings-on is space-time, real existing space-time, and the fundamental contents of that space-time is a particular kind of non-separable field. The link to what we experience is actually going to be much the same as I mentioned for the case of wave function realism. You're going to be able to tell a story about the decoherence giving rise to effectively autonomously evolving decoherent histories of goings-on, obeying quasi-classical laws with the right kinds of symmetries that will make this count as three-dimensional. What will happen in particular standard kinds of measurement case in this setting, though, is that when you're performing a measurement, say a Stern-Gerlach-type measurement, the outcome of that measurement will consist in certain patterns of entanglement being established between spatial regions that one's interested in, between regions where we think of the object system being located and where the pointer variables are located. So there's a slight difference in that one's squishing down the quasi-classical histories all onto one space-time, but that's just a sort of, in a sense, a mathematical rotation. So the link to experience will go the same kind of way as the in the standard wave function realism. Okay, so these are the conclusions then that I want to draw. I think we can find intelligible property bearers and properties to specify an ontology for the quantum state if we want to be a realist about it, if we want to think of it in thing terms. Finding the property bearers, it's crucial to look to the points of the space in which the field is supposed to live. The wave function realist chose a high-dimensional physical space to be the bearers of the properties. They thereby got a separable field in the fundamental ontology. In the space-time state realism, physical arena is normal space-time, but we end up with a non-separable field. And I've tried to suggest that it's the latter approach that should be preferred. It gives us a univocal ontological picture across the different quantum theories. We have a very natural role emerging for space-time, and we don't have an unnatural preference for a particular set of dynamical variables in the way in which we pick out the fundamental ontology. Was there another little point I wanted to make? Possibly, but I'll stop there. Thanks, folks.
I have a question of clarification. Do I understand you correctly? If we take one point of space-time, then the field associated with it is a density operator.
Yeah, and if we take a different open region,
point, it's a different density operator.
Mm-hmm.
What if we take two points?
Then it'll be some other density operator.
So it won't be. Presumably, it's consistent in that if I throw this one away, I recover that one. If I throw that one away,
that's right. So the ones for the subsystems will be the trace of the ones for the bigger one.
Okay, but the bigger one isn't uniquely specified by
right.
the two.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, that's all I wanted to.
So normally we specify a region of space-time via some reference objects or something. You say, you know, it's so many meters from mm-hmm. that wall or something like that. Now, your analysis should apply to the Everett theory. In different Everett branches, the galaxies would be in different places and so on. You'd have no reference objects that you could count on from one branch to another.
Mm-hmm.
So how could you re-identify the same region of space in these different branches, which I think you'd have, or is that just taken as an assumption that that you can take regions of space-time as your subsystems?
That is an assumption, but the particular example you give is a facet of a general phenomenon, and that's going to be observers living in agents, cognitive agents living in a world of this kind, are typically going to be wrong about what the actual state of their region of space-time is, because they're actually going to be just living in they're going to be living in a substructure of the field associated with a particular space-time region. So there'll be a convex decomposition, approximately unique natural convex decomposition of the density operator associated with a particular spatio-temporal region, each component of which corresponds to, as it were, an Everett branch, or a locally defined Everett branch. And people living here are only going to be able to specify the state. By their measurements, they can only specify this state, which is a component of the total state. Now, is that epistemically disastrous? I don't really think so. I think it's just the facet of the general phenomenon that we tend to have to infer about the global structure of the world from a limited data set. I think we face that problem all the time. So I don't think it's disastrous about the fact that just from straightforward inference from what's directly observable in our region won't specify the true state of the region. That's not to rule out the possibility that there might be traces left by which we could do cosmology and infer what the initial state of the universe was, know what the dynamics was by being very careful experimenters and lucky latches on law-like regularities, and thereby infer what the true state of the universe is. But we have to take seriously the idea that particularly when we're doing fundamental physics, we make hypotheses about the world as a whole, the universe as a whole, on the basis of evidence which doesn't entail them. And that's just the general form of inference here. So I think your specific case would be just an example of that general problematic. So one's grip on... one could talk about... I suppose there might be an issue here if one were a relationist about spatiotemporal structure. So if one thought that space-time isn't really fundamental, really what's fundamental are the actual and possible relations between material bodies, then there might be more of a substantive worry here, but I'm not sure. But I mean, it's a good question to pose, I think.
So a comment and a question. So you were mentioning electromagnetism as if it were a very trivial and simple case to interpret, saying that it's okay, there are just these fields and they're very simple. But obviously, there are a whole range of choices. I mean, you could choose the vector potentials and...
No, you'd be mad to, though, wouldn't you?
Sorry?
You'd be mad to, though, wouldn't you?
No, Feynman did, and I don't think he was mad. Or you could choose holonomies, and each has, they've all got their own virtues. I mean, it's not a very... there are different formulations, and the different formulations have non-trivial interpretive implications.
Well, maybe. I mean, so my claim needn't be that the... thinking of the Maxwell tensors specifying the fundamental ontology of EM is the only way of going there. My claim need only be that's an intelligible candidate ontology. I mean, it also happens that I think it's the right ontology. So, maybe a loopy one like Richard's, like Richard Healy's might be a better one. But all we need is that it's intelligible to think of the electromagnetic field itself as being a really existing thing.
So just a very quick second question. So you were mentioning that this is based on space-time regions. So an obvious question is how this extends into general relativistic situations where obviously space-time regions aren't diffeomorphism invariant things. Have you thought anything about that? How it would extend?
Not much. I mean, it's a good question. It's clearly going to be straightforward if you go over to just a single curved space-time. It's not really going to make much difference there. But I don't know what would happen in detail in the moving over to the full dynamical space. I suppose so long as one's not actually trying to quantize the space-time too, then maybe it goes over straightforwardly. But beyond that, I wouldn't want to hazard a guess.
I'd just like to ask about comment you made that. Have wave function realism on this very high dimensional configuration or higher dimensional space, then there's no 3D space in the fundamental ontology.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that seems fair enough if you're talking about, say, a theory of particles on a background space. I wondered if you'd thought about, well, what if I have theories where, for instance, I'm looking at a quantum theory of gravity, and say I have a curved three-dimensional space that is dynamical, evolving in time. In such a theory, the configuration would be a curved free space with fields or particles on it. It seems to me that in that case, well, there's a sense in which the 3D space would be part of the fundamental ontology. I wondered if you'd thought about that.
Not really. I mean, this is this particular interpretive ding-dong is really just to say there's another option on the table as opposed to wave function realism, which works better in certain cases. But no, I haven't thought about how this carries over to quantizing the gravitational field in a case at all. No.
Thanks. Howard Wiseman. So that was one of the questions I was going to ask as well is why, I mean, you seem to be before being saying something even stronger, which was that there was no way that you could deal with quantized space-time fields, you know, in this approach. And it seems like, you know, why would physicists be interested in an approach which rules out from the beginning, you know, quantizing gravity, which is obviously, you know, the aim of a lot of things. And in that, so then building on that then, so you criticize the idea of using configuration space as property bearers or whatever the term was. Why, I would have thought if Lev Biden or something was here, he'd probably say something like, well, I don't need that. Hilbert space is my you know, property bearer or something. You know, I have a wave function on Hilbert space.
That falls prey immediately to the distinction between the representation and the represented. Hilbert space is a mathematical object which plays a part on the representation side. Hilbert space can't be a fundamental physical thing. That's just a category mistake.
So can you explain? I don't understand why how you can know so confidently that configuration space can be a physical thing, but Hilbert space can't. I don't understand.
Well, so, I mean, just pay attention to the distinction between what we use to talk about the world and what we end up thereby talking about. I mean, that's the distinction here. We can postulate a bunch of mathematical objects, and we can say this thing stands in some kind of representational relation to the world. Now, of course, you have to use representations in order to talk about the world. But there's still a difference between a table and a description of a table. There's a distinction between a Hilbert space with a quantum state in it and that which is described by that set of objects if one's a realist about the representational relation into the world. This is just a category distinction. It's for the same kind of reason that numbers aren't the same kinds of things as sticks and stones. This is just a fundamental distinction in logical category.
I'm intrigued by the idea that we can figure out how to understand various structures by looking at their role in the theory. And it strikes me that the role of this density operator is pretty well defined in the ordinary way of thinking about quantum theories. So to take it out of that role and put it into a role as representing reality seems to be so distorting its role that this is beginning to look like a conspiracy theory. Now, we were talking about the right thing, but we had its role completely wrong. That's provocative. To be less provocative, can you say more about what its role now is?
Well, it's going to be just what kind of detailed story does one want? The detail is really going to come out when you actually model real physical systems. I mean, that's where you're going to really get the cash value of doing this kind of thing. As to the cheating, because we become familiar by it by its relation to probability distributions and measurements. Well, fine, that's true. But the realist about quantum mechanics in general, quite irrespective of this particular flavor of realist that I'm saying, has exactly that problem. Sure, we get used to the standard manner in which the theory is linked up to experiment. But the response to this question would be, well, why are let me back the question back. So why are the probabilities that one gets out thus and so? Well, because there's this thing, the density operator, which specifies the physical properties, which entails that the probabilities are thus and so. So the density operator is that thing which corresponds to some physical property of this device, which gives you the real single case probabilities for the outcomes of measurement. How does it manage to do that? Well, then you'd have to tell your story about the detailed dynamical analysis of measurement and all the rest of it, and you get into that kind of story. So, this is a question for the realist project as a whole, and I don't really see a fundamental problem, A, for the realist project as a whole from that, or B, for this particular version of it.
I think I can understand the answer, but I need to see the details because I'm a little skeptical you can pull it off.
Just a comment to, in connection with some of the comments that started with Bill's, by them on Wayne Myhrvold. It seems to me that the general approach you have doesn't have as much problem extending to something like a quantum gravity context as it might seem to be. Because if I understand what your approach is, the basic idea is you figure out what the observables of the theory are, and then states are normalized functionals on those observables. And if you've got a natural subsystem decomposition, you can associate states by, you know, the reduced states with those subsystems. And then you get your space-time state realism if, in addition, those observables can be associated with regions in one big, one common space-time. But that's, I guess, extra structure, and then you might get a preferred subsystem decomposition in terms of space-time regions, but that's only one way a subsystem decomposition could go. So I think it wouldn't be that problematic for this general kind of picture if yeah. there isn't a common space-time you can embed all this stuff in.
That's right, actually. My hesitation is just that I know so lamentably little about proposals in quantum gravity that I don't want to stick my neck out. But that, I mean, that's the general picture that we have. It's that, you know, look at natural decomposition into subsystems and then look at the states on those things.
And just one little comment. In a precursor to this paper, there was a rather appalling position called quantum state nihilism, which was attributed to some guy named Merveld,
yeah.
which I protested, as you recall. I think that actually the position that I was, you know, at least in the back of my mind in my relativistic quantum becoming paper, is an awful lot like this quantum state realism. So I'm certainly very sympathetic to the whole thing.
Okay, good.
Can you formulate the dynamics for your local beables without the wave function?
What do you mean wave function? It was trivial. We've got it. It's harder to go to the wave function than to start with the density operator, I could say.
Well,
there's no complication. I mean, the transformation is totally trivial.
Well, that's maybe we can talk about that later, because I had a different question in mind. That maybe is more interesting to ask. You mentioned some of these other theories that posit local beables, like Bohm's theory and mm-hmm. you know, various flavors of GRW with the extra stuff in it. And one of the nice things, at least from a certain perspective, about all of those theories is that there's a clear mapping from the local beables that they posit to one's experience. And you know,
right.
Bell talks about this as psychophysical parallelism. And it doesn't seem nearly as clear that in this theory it works out so simply, and it seems like what you get is probably some kind of many worlds picture of a bunch of overlapping worlds in, you know, 3+1 space-time. Do you have any comments about that?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's almost exactly the way that Tim Maudlin would put his worries with this kind of approach, and he puts it specifically with a wave function realist approach. He says it's cheating precisely because you don't have a real three-dimensional space in the background with real stuff in it. It's cheating to pretend that you can understand what this mathematical object you've written down is actually saying about how the world of experience would be. Now, we're denying that it's a necessary condition to have a suitable link-up with experience that one postulates those particular kinds of local beables. But you're dead right that the story is going to be more messy and more complicated. But you might, in the long run, it might turn out to be more physically realistic. As to many worldsiness, clearly this picture does fit very naturally with the many worlds approach. One question I haven't, and actually I think equally well with the GRW, bare GRW approach, because I mean, then you're just going to kill off some stuff occasionally. But with the Bohmian picture, I'm not so sure actually what's going to happen, whether you can get, certainly we don't have the nice picture of the field pushing particles around here. And I worry that if we have, because of the complexity of the properties that are going to be defined at a particular point, it might be troublesome for the little particles to know which way to get pushed. So that there might be some messiness in the account here. It might be possible to formulate it's surely going to be mathematically possible to formulate how the rules would look here, but it might look somewhat awkward for the Bohmian, but perhaps not impossible.
I like a lot of what I'm hearing here, but I'm concerned that you're taking this structure, this density matrix that was specifically designed to describe measurements at instantaneous flat hypersurfaces, and you're saying, okay, now we're going to map this onto a four volume now and say this region in space-time now has a row of its own that can't evolve anymore because now we're in a block universe picture, and so there's no additional time for it to evolve. Do you imagine it being sort of at the future edge of this four volume, where that's where the measurement occurs, and that's, or you imagine it sort of belongs to the whole volume and it just doesn't evolve?
Right. I mean, that's what any four-dimensional block picture is going to look like. doesn't stop there being laws of nature. Those are going to give you temporal evolution relating bits within. They're going to relate atemporally bits within this four-dimensional block.
Well, but the measurement can happen inside the block. That's happened.
Right.
At the end of the block.
Yeah, so there'll be some measurement measurement outcomes, determinate pointer positions and so on, will supervene on the states specified within particular spatiotemporal regions. So there will be some regions within which there is structure which is the reading, you know, the pointer pointing here. That's what the picture is going to be.
Okay, folks, I think it's time for coffee. Let's thank Chris again.
Thanks.